Welcome to Unboxing Queer History, a podcast from Gerber Hart Library and Archives. Gerber Hart is an independent nonprofit library and archives with collections that focus on the LGBTQ+ history of Chicago and the Midwest. This season was made possible by a Broadening Narratives grant from the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation and by support from listeners like you. Thank you. Today, we hear from Chijoke Williams about erotica at Gerber Hart and who is and isn't represented in this unique collection. Collection that we have at Gerber Hart, this is what I believe to be one of the largest collections of queer erotica, at least in Chicago, possibly the Midwest, possibly the nation. We have thousands and thousands of items in this one tiny temperature-controlled room, and it is so illuminating to just walk up and down those very narrow aisles, to look at titles, to look at the models and the actors and the people that are on the covers of these magazines or the covers of these videos and DVDs. You start having conversations about what erotica really is and about what it really means to us. And through that, through those conversations and that line of thinking, we start to realize how important those magazines really were, not just to us experiencing our sexuality and like feeling okay about our attractions, but also as a way of connecting with other people.
When I first heard about Gerber Hart's archive, with thousands of samples of historical queer erotica from more than the past 5 decades, I nearly tripped over myself getting in there. I'm not ashamed to say that when it comes to sex, I am a nerd. I have been for as long as I could read. I was listening to Dan Savage's Savage Love by age 13, devouring The Ethical Slut and learning about polyamory before high school, and acting out scenes from my favorite Harlequin romances before I ever read The Catcher in the Rye. Eat your heart out, Holden Caulfield. I love sex. Not just on a personal level, but on a sociological, anthropological, and historical level. Growing up, it was easy to find stories about cis-straight women and men. They're a dime a dozen. But as a trans sapphic myself, I've always been fascinated by erotica that features the stories we don't hear all that often. Lesbian romance novels were rare treats, because they often captured the pining that I personally felt but never saw in straight literature. And if I found a book with trans characters, whew, I'd read it over and over until it fell to pieces in my hands. Those books were a huge part of my formative years because they allowed me to see my polyamorous, trans, pansexual self in fiction, even if I hadn't met anyone in person who was like me. As I grew up and consumed more and more erotic content, I realized, by tracking the prevalence, or rarity, of erotica, you can learn a lot about the people who create that material, and the people who consume it. Fast forward 15 years to the moment I dove into Gerber Hart's erotica archive. I was so excited to find their lesbian erotica collection. I wanted to see their mountains of magazines, their vintage VHSs, and especially their fantastically trashy pulp novels. But that's not what I found, at least not at first.
I'm a shift lead, which means that I open and close and supervise Thursday nights.
This is Dominic.
And as a volunteer, I kind of do whatever is needed of me. I help researchers by finding materials in the archive for them and giving them suggestions. We focus on print media, right? So we have dozens of magazines and manuscripts and monographs of erotic materials spanning from the beginning of the 20th century through to today, right? Primarily focusing on the 60s, 70s, and 80s as like sort of the golden age of gay male erotica.
Walking into the archives can be overwhelming. There are so many shelves, so many hundreds of selections of erotic gay novels and magazines to choose from, including, but not limited to, Cult Men, Bound and Gagged, Advocate Men, Cruise, Inches, Indulge, 100% Beef, Daddy.
And of course, we have a super extensive collection of audiovisual material, so thousands of VHS and DVD from the 70s onwards, including international stuff. And what's really cool is that we have about several hundred boxes of unmarked 8mm and Super 8 reels of pornographic material that no one has watched.
This is Paul Cobesa, another of Gerber Hart's erotica guys.
One of the organizing principles of Gerber Hart is to preserve LGBTQ culture regardless of the format. And so erotica, pornography, all the things that fall in that spectrum are an important expression of this culture and therefore are worthy of being collected, preserved, organized, and made accessible.
This is Stephen Farias.
During the 80s, during that time period, when people were passing away and dying, a lot of it was just being disposed of. So to be able to have this in our collection, I think is extremely important.
When you look at it over its period of production, you can see how gay male erotica started reflecting the arc of HIV/AIDS from the very beginning through the safe sex movement, which was roughly paralleled by the no holds barred movement. People saying, wait a minute, we fought to express our sexuality and now you're telling us to not go to the baths. And you see that arc when you look over time, if you look from the late 70s to the mid 90s. And that's one of the things that helps me explain to people why we collect this material. It is certainly culturally important. And when you look at a topic like the emergence of HIV/AIDS, it's historically and epidemiologically important.
I think it's great that we have material available so that, you know, you don't feel like you're alone, that you have a place to come where it's like, you know, you mean something as well, that you're not being left out. So I think that's the importance of a lot of the collection for me. It's like everybody's welcome.
The HIV/AIDS crisis was obviously a dark time in America's history. And while the idea for Gerber Hart actually predated the rise of HIV, the subsequent public health crisis greatly shaped the library's early years and collections. We lost so many people, so many living pieces of our history. And during the AIDS crisis, homophobes destroyed many examples of gay content. A lot of the material from before the 70s and 80s still can't be found anywhere. It's gone, permanently. So it's no surprise that the archive's founders created a place to keep the materials that they still had. And let's be clear, there may not be any other place like Gerber Hart. A queer library is a rare and beautiful thing, even without a public health crisis that ravaged our community. But the inclusion of thousands of samples of historical erotica and sexual content also makes it controversial.
I do think that there are some funders that are a bit leery of supporting Gerber Hart because our collection does include erotica. And just to say that there are still dangers, downsides, and concerns when it comes to us collecting erotica at Gerber Hart.
Gerber Hart doesn't receive federal funding. They apply for specific grants and appeal to private donors. But their sexual content disqualifies them for several grants and resources that don't want to be connected to a queer erotica archive.
Certain government funders, potentially politicians, the risk of, the headline of, politician supports porn, I think makes people nervous about the fact that our collection does contain erotica. So there are still difficulties and dangers when it comes to collecting erotica.
They're lost, though. I'd actually vote for a politician who didn't suppress their sexuality for once. But maybe that's just me. Gerber Heart was founded on a beautiful dream, with the noble goal of preserving a gay culture that was actively being erased. And it worked. They have thousands of samples of gay erotica, magazines, and media. But they may have overcorrected. By working to preserve the legacies of gay men, they inadvertently glossed over some other important groups.
I would say our erotica is less than 20%, like lesbian and femme, to 80% gay, male, gay mask. It's less than that, though. It's even less than that. I could tell you just broadly in our erotica collection, we have materials dating back to the 40s and 50s, and then that goes all the way up to the 2000s. The 40s and 50s materials are primarily the what we call the pre-Stonewall collection, and they are a lot of like physique pictorial bodybuilding magazines, and then some very early special collections books that were about gay erotica, like early gay BDSM kinds of materials that were published back then too. I'm sad that there isn't a broader representation in our current erotica collection, that it is primarily a lot of cis white men. But to have an exhibit space where we could highlight the women, the femme, we could highlight stories of like trans, or what is trans erotica? What does erotica look like for anybody, any community within the queer umbrella?
Speaking of being made welcome, in this episode, we'll be talking about gender and identity, using words that not everyone in the LGBTQ+ community will feel represented by. Gender is an intensely personal experience, and sexual identity is no different. Some people prefer to be referred to as femmes rather than women. Some people prefer the term mask to butch. Some femme folks love the term lesbian and find it affirming. Some don't. Some transmasculine folks still use the term, while others find it invalidating. Some people identify with their assigned gender at birth. And some, like me, really, really don't. All of these are valid labels to choose, but a label is never completely accurate. As a trans woman with overlapping identities, I want to acknowledge the breadth and depth of these experiences, while also acknowledging the limits of our language, and the fact that language changes over time. I love the idea of the archive tracing the way marginalized language and culture has changed. Like trends around the way people of color are humanized, or objectified, in erotica, or plotting the prevalence of trans representation from the 70s till now. In an ideal world, Gerber Heart's collection would offer the chance to track the way things like language, gender expression, and sexuality have evolved over time. Considering the scarcity of the materials featuring these groups, I don't see this being easy, per se, but I do think it's possible. It would mean the world to look into the archive and see my own identities reflected back. I can absolutely see that happening in the future. But for now...
Yeah, it's kind of slim pickings when it comes to material with women in it.
This is Jen Dintel.
I am Gerber Heart's Community Outreach and Strategic Partnerships Manager.
This is Erin Bell.
I'm the Operations Director at Gerber Heart.
And this is Sarah Dysack.
I own and run a sex toy store called Early to Bed.
The lesbian content that Gerber Heart has may be relatively minimal, but it means so much to the people who seek it out, as well as the people who collect it. And though the sample size is small, their historical and cultural value is immeasurable.
I was actually interested in representation of queer women's sexuality before I even had a sex toy store. And because women's sexuality as a whole had been left out of everything. When magazines started coming out, like in the 90s, I was just like voracious. On Our Backs had like the longest tenure as a magazine. And it was, when you compare it to mainstream pornography, it was black and white newsprint pictures. It did not have the money. It didn't have the polish. It was definitely less professional, which is great. We have a lot of magazines, specifically queer women magazines, which aren't a lot.
There are three main lesbian publications that I will always point people to. On Our Backs had some really early representation of trans masc folks, and I think that it was a really, really beautiful publication.
Some of the covers of On Our Backs or like Fat Girl, it's just people. Like, it's just people. It could be my friends just like sitting and laughing and smiling and like feeling hot and being hot.
And it had pictorials, explicit pictorials. They were shot by professionals, but it had a very different look than like mainstream porn. Black and white pictures and not professional models, which was awesome, right? Much more representation of what dykes, queer women, actually looked like. And I think that was part of what was so revolutionary about it.
It's accessible, and it's just folks like you and me, and it's really beautiful.
And then, of course, there was sex advice columns. So it was really like a culture magazine as well.
It was prolific. I think it featured articles, safe sex features. We've got, you know, advertisements for different sex toys and boutiques, and they've got photo stories, and it was just a celebration of women's sexuality, of lesbian women's sexuality. They're just absolutely beautiful windows into that time period of lesbian life.
Much more explicit. There was definitely Bush, and it was the 90s, so there was Bush.
It wasn't just white women on the covers. I think you see a variety of different people that are on the covers, in the stories. We have a few issues of this 90s zine erotic magazine called Fat Girl that's amazing. We have a collection of Bad Attitude, which is another lesbian erotic magazine. The more you look through them, you also see the ads, the events, the publications celebrating women's sexuality and queer women's sexuality.
It was one of the few ways that you could see this representation of real, genuine queer women sexuality and the kind of also assorted conversations about it in one place. It was a really important publication, and it was porn.
Real Dykes Wear Flannel is one, and it's just this beautiful like autumnal cover with like flannel. Girls That Wear Glasses was a whole series.
Like, they definitely had a wide range of gender expression for the time. How were we reacting to the patriarchy via sex? Like, the fact that dildos used to be seen as a tool of the patriarchy because they went in a vagina, and that you were a bad lesbian if you used them. Just the stuff that you're just like, whoa, that was a time in our culture? Like, we can buy vibrators at Target now, right? I don't recommend it, but we can, and that's fantastic in so many ways.
That is so cool, and that's so divorced from this concept of what straight pornography is. Erotica is not this dangerous thing that we were told, like, we're not allowed to touch or handle.
Clearly, publications like On Our Backs hold a special place in the lives of queer women who were around to read them at the time. When it comes to preserving lesbian history and culture, archival magazines are one of our best resources.
They're about sex, but they're also this incredible time capsule of what was going on with gender in queer communities, with sexuality is a bigger statement in queer communities. I think that we lost something that can be so specifically held as a historic document in a way that feels so easily accessible. Like, you can see what dykes looked like in 1998 by reading this magazine and what we were fighting about with each other back then, whatever it is. And so I'm like, okay, maybe it's my job to try and keep some of this history so that we have a knowledge. We have some porn, and I just keep holding on to it, thinking someday someone will need it.
Sarah's instincts were solid. Gerberhardt has been struggling to collect lesbian content for years, without even knowing that Early to Bed, right down the street, held a sizable collection. And when I asked Sarah why she hadn't donated to Gerberhardt, she made a point that, I believe, sheds a little light on why our collection might be so small.
Let's talk about some fucked up dynamics about how we view feminine sex. I think also I have this weird rejection fear that my collection is not worthy, even though I didn't make any of it. The idea that if you have one copy of this magazine, why you're not going to need all of them. I think that I personally value this very high, but I undervalue it because of the inherent nature of how we view women's sexuality, even though if this is the place for it, of course.
The message that lesbian sex is of less value or not worth preserving, it's pervasive and can even affect someone whose life and livelihood revolve around sex positivity. Luckily, Sarah isn't the only one in the community with an investment in uncovering and preserving lesbian erotica.
Sex in San Francisco.
This is Ash Bridges reading Sex in San Francisco from an unlabeled lesbian magazine.
Well, yes, I'm sure it still happens. Sometimes I even get up the energy to participate, but for me, the subject is mostly a nostalgic one. It takes me back to the baths of the early 80s when I was a newcomer to the city and I needed to try out every possible venue now. The Liberty Baths, the 21st Street Baths, which I always confused with the Liberty since it was at the corner of 21st and Liberty, the Bulldog and Animals, these are the ones that come immediately to mind. All closed, alas, by court order during the reign of our former mayor, now Senator Feinstein. Some things should never be forgiven or forgotten.
Ash and Eli, another Gerber Hart volunteer, put on a recent exhibit showcasing Gerber Hart's lesbian and trans erotica. Beyond displaying the importance of erotica as a time capsule, the exhibit really highlighted how sparse Gerber Hart's lesbian collection is compared to their gay male content. Seeing the quality of the lesbian content they did have, I had to wonder how many boxes of lesbian erotica Gerber Hart held overall.
And the answer was 1.5 out of the whole archive that we found so far.
This is Eli L.A.
So when I show up in any queer archive space, one of my first questions is, where is the porn for women? Because this has been, you know, where is it? This has been historically, what do women want? Why can't we make porn that women like? However, in queer spaces, it's even more complicated because also who are women? Who are trans people? Who are non-binary people? Like, the identities become so much more fluid and complex. And every queer archive I've ever known about, walked into, every porn section in any bookstore has this problem that there isn't porn specifically for or about anyone who isn't a white guy. There's so many people in Chicago who this would mean something to. Let's get them all together and talk about it and talk about how we can do better. And then I learned how much Gerber Hart suffers, like so many porn archives and queer archives suffer, from not having a diversity of people in them. It's not inherently the archive's fault, but it does mean that it's hard to get to know who your ancestors really were and who their interlocutors were. Something that's kind of amazing about the queer community is that because queer people are everywhere and come in every shape, size, and color, we tend to know people who are not like us more than the average straight person. However, our archives frequently don't reflect that, and that is because of privilege, and it is because people have been oppressed and their stories have been oppressed. So I really wanted to know, where am I in this archive, and where are people who I know in this archive? And that's when Ash and I decided to find them. And we started looking for anything in the Gerber Hart Porn Archive that was about queer, non-binary, trans people, trying to find things about people of color, trying to get a sense of what that was like in Chicago, since it's an undertold story, but it also, there isn't a lot of material generally.
Here's Eli, Ash, and Jen sharing some of their favorites from the content they pulled for the exhibit. There's not a lot, but one of the most iconic examples of underground queer literatica is part of Gerber Hart's collection.
I'm finally reading Macho Sluts by Califia, and it is incredible. And it's just like the introduction is just this really discussion about kink and some of the conflicts with feminism and the larger LGBTQ community, and like a very unapologetic look at kink. And I think it's an important conversation. I think that erotica and kink were often really challenged in the mainstream LGBTQ community. So defending it and having that evidence, I think, is really beautiful.
Here's Jen reading from Macho Sluts.
Why has it taken so long for any sex books, whether their jackets are leather or flannel, by and for lesbians to be written? How does this new genre of porn function? Sex may seem like a trivial part of a radical futuristic vision, but if we are not safe to indulge in this playful, vulnerable, and necessary activity, pleasure ourselves and the others who fascinate us, how safe can society be for women? But if enough of us speak out about our dreams and obsessions, a body of genuine knowledge can accumulate and make all of us feel less crazy and less alone with what we cannot live without.
So, we've talked about the erotica Gerberhart doesn't have, but they do have a sizable collection of lesbian pulp novels and romances aimed at women. And somehow, whatever factors have led to the rarity of visual lesbian erotica doesn't seem to have affected this collection. It should be noted that the erotic lesbian novels and romances at Gerberhart actually live in the main library, not the archive. While they are still counted as erotica, their less overtly explicit nature may be why they aren't in the same collection, but it's hard to say. As I mentioned, I love lesbian pulp novels. The trashier, the better. But in the process of investigating their library of literotica, I began to realize why there are more novels for women than visually explicit material. It's kind of fascinating. Gerberhart has explicit gay erotica going back to the 50s and 60s. But the lesbian erotica collection is much more recent and sparse. On Our Backs didn't come out until 1984, but their novel collection does go back much further.
The pulp novels that we have, those dating back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, were some of the earliest examples of stories about lesbians having sex, seeking out women. It's both like a sexual tale as well as a romance tale.
Now there's just thriving queer romance. There's so much lesbian and queer romance, and it's fantastic. But I think the romance community is largely women writing for other women. And I think that within that, because it is a women's genre, I think it is not taken seriously, because it's like, oh, these are these, you know, trashy books that grandmas read on a bus. And it's like, okay, if you want to think that, like, have you read one of these books? And I think that because it's not taken seriously, these romance novels are a space where people can kind of create, you know, and have their own fantasies and have their own, you know, women are actually advocating for what they want in those books. And I think that that's something that we don't get to hear that in other spaces. And I think it's because it is this industry that is so dominated by women. And I think pulp novels are a little bit of a different situation, but it is a similar case where it's a genre that was treated as so disposable and trashy that no one was really watching what people were doing in those books. So in some cases, you have these lesbian and bisexual authors like Valerie Taylor that are able to use this pulp novel genre to put all of this activist information in this trashy book, and then it reached people. You know, so you're able to use these books that, if it was quote-unquote highbrow literature, would have been really policed and censored. But because pulp's not taken seriously, because porn's not taken seriously, because of romance novels aren't taken seriously, there's this kind of liminal gray space where people can push boundaries, and I am so fascinated by that, and I love it.
Here's Jen reading from The Celluloid Closet.
There are lots of needs for art, and the greatest one is the mirror of our own lives and our own existence. And that hunger that I felt as a kid, looking for gay images, was to not be alone.
It seems like lesbian novels were able to proliferate and gain more traction simply because the people who would normally have been critical of them didn't take them seriously. Because they featured women together, lacked pictures of it, and were supposedly trashy, they were actually able to reach their target audience. And if the lesbians who read these books love the genre anywhere as much as I do, it makes sense that they'd hold on to them as long as they could. But there are more reasons behind the archive's sparse lesbian collection. I'd like to think there's a fair amount of weight to these ideas.
I think that there was a lot more gay male erotic content created than material for lesbians and queer women. That could be, you know, for a variety of reasons.
Our first organizers and a lot of the early contributors to the library have been cis, white, gay men. The collections we've received are very much reflective of their desires, their tastes, the publications they sought out. So therefore, it is a lot of periodicals that appealed to cis, white, gay men. I'm not saying that those are bad. I'm not saying that the materials we have are bad, but it's not everything. And I do think it speaks to the limitations there were for women and femme presenting people that wanted to have erotica that appealed to them. They would have to have self-published. They would be more like zines. They would have to have literally, like, lesbians making their own publishing houses so they could publish their materials, because within the queer market, the bigger names were primarily, like, gay male voices in the adult video and magazine markets.
As far as barriers to creating content, financial limits were a significant impediment. Women couldn't even legally open credit cards or bank accounts until 1974.
It wasn't until the last 50 years that women were able to actually have financial autonomy, and that women could start thinking about opening their own, like, financing their own publishing houses and video production companies and things like that. It would not surprise me if a majority of zines or self-published materials were more widely representative of lesbians and basically non-cis gay men, because that was what women had access to, and that's what they could do.
Gay male erotica, they're men, so they've always been prioritized, and so much more of it was made. And men have historically have had more money to purchase the erotica, so there's more money in gay male erotica. And on the collection side, right, the archive was founded primarily by gay men, and there's more of it circulating, so more of it ends up being donated.
There were some lesbian women that were also part of Gerberhardt's early days, and I would love to know what materials they contributed or wanted to contribute, but I don't know. I don't know if they were asked. I don't know if they were, if their materials were being sought out. The early days were so focused on just making sure we had materials, that we had a library, that we had materials speaking to our history.
I think for women, there can often be a lot more kind of punishing shame that comes with sexuality. So I think that that is a kind of a cultural heritage that is difficult to overcome sometimes. So when it comes to sharing, like, these are my secret precious materials, and bringing them in and sharing them very publicly, I think that that can be, I think they can exist at the same time. Our collection is all donated, so it really depends on who is bringing in materials. That can kind of go multiple ways. So it could be who is already donating materials, who then tells their friends to donate materials.
But what materials count as lesbian content? Is it based on who makes it, who it was made for, or something else entirely? How do we tell lesbian content from content for bisexuals, or even straight men? If we're going to talk about lesbian content, modern or archival, we have to address the male gaze.
Women, whether that is queer women or straight women, if their sexuality was portrayed, it was through this male gaze. And I think that, to me, is just fascinating slash depressing, that women have been left out of this conversation about their own sexuality for so long.
With women, there's always kind of a co-opting of our sexuality for male pleasure. So I think that there is a, even within, and I think often, especially with, you know, lesbian sex as something that becomes this thing that is attracting straight men, because they, you know,
are looking to be part of that. Like, it becomes, same thing with bisexual women, it becomes like, okay, so you want a threesome. It's like, that's the immediate response. So I think that there is this way that even our own sexuality is not ours. It's a frustrating dichotomy where, you know, at least like with straight women too, you are expected to both be completely not sexual and then just the most sexual at the same end. So there's the shame of not being like available to men in a certain way, but then also the shame of being a sexual person. So you kind of have, you can never win. With women's sexuality, I think there's often with queer women, with lesbians, there is a rejection of that kind of being available for the male gaze. So doing things not for men. I think that when it comes to the ways that women have been involved in the erotic business or with, you know, with sex work, I think it's just a more complicated history in a lot of cases.
That history makes consuming lesbian content an equally complicated experience. I can't help but ask, whose idea was this scene? Did the actresses get to give any input? Was it directed by a man? And if it was, would I even be able to tell?
So the question is, can you tell the difference between lesbian porn made by women for women and lesbian porn made for men or made for the male gaze?
This is Mel Leverage. They're the collections librarian at the Leather Archives, a local museum of historical queer and kinky ephemera dating back to 1991. In the same way that Gerber Hart is an archive of queer news and history, the Leather Archives is a treasure trove of kinky history and artifacts.
So, a lot of what we have is kink and leather pornography that features women. And a lot of it has women together, a lot of it is created by women, a lot of it has women submitting their own content or posting personal ads, seeking other women. Often people will distinguish between lesbian porn that's made by and for lesbians and lesbian porn that's made for men or made for a male gaze. I think it's actually really hard to tell the difference, especially with kink and especially with leather. So in the 1970s, there was no kinky lesbian porn made by women for women, per se. There was kinky lesbian porn made by women for everyone. And it often featured femme women. But who's to say that's not also for women? Who's to say that women can't also be attracted to femininity? So this magazine that I'm looking at, it was created by a woman. So this is Bound to Please. It was published by House of Milan. And the executive editor and publisher of House of Milan is Barbara Bear. So Barbara Bear created this empire of kinky publishing in the 1970s. It almost all features women. And a lot of it features women with other women. So at the time, this is lesbian pornography. Like, this is created by a woman. It's of women. It's women in bondage. It's women in kinky scenarios. We can assume that it was primarily men purchasing this for a few reasons. Men have more purchasing power. Men have more access to pornography in general in the 70s. But also for any women who are interested in kink, this is it. Like, this is what you can get. I don't look at this and see or presume a male gaze personally. So a number of these are women who are in sort of high femme outfits, corsets, high heels, but not necessarily all of them. So they're just because there are feminine women present, I think sometimes people assume, oh, this is for men. It's men who want to see feminine women. The femdom magazines are also mostly published by women. And all the content is created by women. And you'll notice almost all the ads inside are women, both cis women and trans women. Is this not kind of lesbian porn?
In the conversation over whether kinky content is for women, many women are told, either passively or directly, that they don't have a space in kink or sex without a man involved. But these magazines, some of them decades old, refute that idea.
So Irving Claw is a famous bondage photographer. Irving Claw's studio was run by his sister, whose name was Paula Claw. So Irving Claw owned the business, all the accounts were in his name. Paula Claw is the one who operated the business. She's the one who took the photographs and arranged all of the models. There's an interview with Paula Claw where she says explicitly, "I posed the models, I tied them up, and I took the photographs. These are my photos. I did this because this is the way that I thought it should be done." We can probably assume that Paula Claw was taking photos that she thought would sell, and that she learned what photos would sell over time based on what was popular, what people were buying. We also don't know who was buying those photos. We can assume it was mostly men. But nevertheless, it's Paula Claw, a woman, who was tying up the models, who was posing them, who was working with them, who was taking the pictures. All of it is her vision, and she's very explicit that it's her creative vision that created these photos, that it was not her brother, Irving Claw. And I don't really believe that all these women are lying. I just don't believe that. That they're just like creating this fantasy persona for men to purchase. Why would they be writing in just readers' letters for no reason? Not as professionals, no return address. Why would they be sending their own photos in to be published? Especially when it was such a huge risk. Like, such a huge risk that someone would see your photo and identify you in it and out you. Why would you do that unless you were genuinely kinky, genuinely wanting to express yourself and find community?
At the end of the day, the issue of gaze seems to be complicated by the fact that women can still enjoy content made by and for men, especially if no content was being made specifically for women at the time. Maybe not every woman, but enough that those who do should be included in the conversation. Still, the Leather Archives are less than a 15-minute walk from Gerber Hart, and yet their lesbian erotica collection dwarfs ours three times over. Since kink and straightness seem to be the only thing separating these archives, why do they get more donations? Does kink make that much of a difference?
There are a few things about the kink world and the leather world that make it a little easier to be openly sexual. A lot of kink content is really need to know. Kink magazines are not very publicly available. You would have to go to a sex shop. You would have to go to the back room of the sex shop in order to find the kinky stuff. And so it's really only people who are already expressing some kind of interest, already taking the brave step of entering into the kink world. So we have all the kink magazines, which are not explicitly LGBT on the surface. So people know that we collect that material, whereas Gerber Hart focuses on more explicitly LGBT material. I didn't know that Gerber Hart didn't have all of On Our Backs. I very rarely see it, though. All of the lesbian magazines that we are offered, if we already have them, I keep them, and I offer them to other institutions because they're so rare and so difficult to find. Mainly, the magazines that we sell are the gay porn magazines, because the gay magazines like Drummer Magazine and Honcho and Mandate, they're so common, they're so easy to find, they're for sale everywhere. But On Our Backs and even lesser known lesbian magazines like Venus and Furs and Fat Girl and Paramore, those are so rare and they're so expensive online that I set them aside whenever I get them to give to another library if it's something we already have, but it almost never happens. Like, we very rarely get donations of lesbian material that we don't already have. So I'm assuming it's just because of the scarcity.
So maybe scarcity plays a part. Maybe shame and secrecy do too. If Gerber Hart doesn't have a reputation for having kinky lesbian erotica, no one will donate that. But if they cultivate one, they may find that changing. The crappy truth is, kink magazines were able to proliferate more and remain funded for longer because their audience was, at least partially, men who had more financial access. In the end, what's missing from Gerber Hart's archives tells us just as much as what is there. lesbian erotica is scarce, not because it didn't exist, but because it was hard to produce, and much of what was made wasn't valued, preserved, or easily donated. The few pieces we do have, On Our Backs, Fat Girl, rare kink magazines, are fragments of a hidden history. Archives like Gerber Hart, founded by gay men, reflect their founders' priorities, but they don't have to reflect our priorities. For years, women have faced the ubiquitous message that their sexuality had less value without a man involved. Even today, erotica created by and for women is often undervalued, overlooked, or ridiculed. But where it does appear, in exhibits like Eli and Ashes, and niche collections like the Leather Archives, in the basement of Early to Bed, it shows a different gaze, a different story. There has always been a demand for lesbian erotica. The problem has never been lack of interest. It's whose stories we've been taught to save.
I think porn is resistance. I think talking about porn is resistance. I think making porn that is positive and collecting it and archiving it and treating it as serious, beautiful, silly culture is part of how we stay alive and thriving.
Gerber Hart believes in erotica. They believe porn is resistance, that our history lives on in our documents, no matter what kind. They believe that knowledge is power, and preserving our history only increases the power we share. No matter how loudly the world devalues the art we make, the memories we record, or the people we are, your story matters. And while Gerber Hart wants all of your stories, they do have one specific request.
Please give us your smut, your pornography.
This episode was written and produced by me, Chijoke Williams, she, her, and edited by Mara Laser. Thank you to Jen Dentel, Aaron Bell, Sarah Dysack, Stephen Farias, Dominic Paul Cobesa, Ash Bridges, Eli L.A., and Mel Leverage for their time and expertise on this story.
This episode was produced by Chijoke Williams and edited by Mara Laser. Unboxing Queer History Season 2 is co-created by Aaron Bell and Jen Dentel. Special thanks to the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation for providing major funding for this season, and for the support of listeners like you. To learn more about how you can support the preservation of our collections and help us continue unboxing queer history, visit gerberhart.org. Next time, join us as we learn about Dyke TV and DIY queer media with Hannah Vitti.